It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, this is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. Doctor Who premiered this week, so Bill Monroe wanted to talk about it, so we get right into it. Of course, this is also the week of the Star Wars The Last Jedi trailer and the Mystery Science Theater premiere on Netflix. So there was a lot to get to. We get to all of it. Here we go.
Exactly. It's amazing how much just stuff has popped up this week.
I know. It never rains, but it pours. There are weeks where Steven and I go, well, what? Nothing. There was nothing. No one's coming over. How about you and I talk about Colossus for an hour? Can we get an hour out of that? And then
you always do.
Yeah, somehow. But you and I plan to talk about the premiere of Doctor Who, which was this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But also Netflix released the new season of Mystery Science Theater 3000. The last time we talked about it on this show is when the Kickstarter was happening.
Right.
But there are 14 more episodes of Mystery Science Theater, which is the first time that's happened since 1999. And then Star Wars Celebration, there was a ton of stuff. I think we can go through that most quickly. There's a Last Jedi trailer that mm-hmm. you mentioned you hadn't seen. It's very good. It doesn't give away too much, and it just gives me confidence about the upcoming film.
Right.
You know, I don't like to dissect trailers too much because I don't like to think about the plot that heavily before I go in.
Well, I think, you know, based on what I've heard other people who are, you know, looking forward to this, who've seen the trailer, who like it, based on what you've said about it so far, I think what's interesting about this trailer is that all it has to do is show you that this is not going to be a bad movie. The previous trailers we saw for The Force Awakens and for Rogue One, they were really sort of breaking us into the Star Wars universe again in a way that Lucas had already lowered the bar for Star Wars so far that you could put out a good trailer for The Force Awakens and people would be blown away by it because it is so much better than anything we've seen from Star Wars before. Whereas this new trailer, it has to sell a movie where The Force Awakens and Rogue One have already raised the bar up to, we know we're going to get something good.
Right. You know, franchises live and die on their last movie, and it doesn't matter how long ago it was or who's involved, but, you know, Force Awakens, for good or bad, was the sequel to Revenge of the Sith. That's what people remember. The same way Batman Begins didn't do as well as The Dark Knight, because Batman Begins was the sequel to Batman and Robin,
right,
which was 8 years ago when it was released, but The Dark Knight was the sequel to Batman Begins. So as good as both of those films are, the reputation of the box office is always living and dying by the last one. People loved Force Awakens, and the impression I got from this trailer of, like, here's Rey, here's Poe Dameron, here's Finn, and, you know, we see some of Luke, but the feeling I got was, oh yeah, we've embraced the new characters, and now we're seeing where they are. Because obviously Rogue One had no characters that were connected to anyone. There's a one-line C-3PO cameo and a CG Peter Cushing.
Right.
And Darth Vader shows up, but the main characters of that film only exist in that film. So those trailers were kind of like just trying to open up the Star Wars universe some more. This focuses on the characters because they know we've accepted the new characters.
Right.
But yeah,
watching that is definitely on my list.
Yeah, I've seen it a couple of times. It's good. I didn't get chills. Like I was more excited about the Thor Ragnarok trailer. than Star Wars. Because, you know, Star Wars has burned me several times.
Right.
That I'm just kind of like, Star Wars is like an ex-girlfriend that's doing well. Like, every now and then I check in with it. I'm like, all right, doing okay. Like, we used to be so tight, and then things mm-hmm. got real bad. And now things are okay again.
Yep.
You know, whereas Marvel never left me. From the moment of seeing Spider-Man on the Electric Company mm-hmm. to seeing Michael Keaton in Spider-Man Homecoming.
It has its ups and its downs, but it's always there.
It's never let me as down as deep as Star Wars has.
Right. It's never broken your heart.
No, but let's, you know, speaking of ups and downs, let's get right into the Doctor Who premiere. This is the first episode after the Christmas special 4 months ago.
It's the first episode after the last two Christmas specials.
Right. It's been 18 months since we've had a season. Going into this, we now know this is it for Peter Capaldi. We knew this was it for Stephen Moffat, but this is also it for Peter Capaldi. And it's the introduction of a new companion.
Yes.
So how did you feel?
This was the best Doctor Who season premiere since Asylum of the Daleks. It was... I thought it was fantastic. It hit all the right notes. It's a great jumping on point for new Who fans, with the way they took it as a reasonably slow pace to introduce the core concepts of the Whoniverse. The new companion, I like her. She gets a real nice introduction. It's a very simple story taking place in here from a plot perspective that really lets us get. Learn more character stuff about the new companion. And I really like it. I think it hit all the right notes. I love what they're doing with the music in this episode, with the tighter theme music, with it, the swelling music in the right parts and taking it away in the other parts. And I am just all kinds of pleased with how this episode turned out, and it's really got me looking forward to the rest of the season and really jealous of whoever it was that got to decorate the doctor's office at the university.
Yeah, it was definitely a smaller story than other season premieres we got. I would think last season we had Missy and we had the Dalek homeworld that was invisible, and it seems I keep thinking of Peter Capaldi's first appearance where a dinosaur barfs up the TARDIS and then bursts into flame. Mm-hmm. they usually pull out all the stops. And this was just about, it was a very typical Doctor Who story of the companion's a normal person, a woman, which is you more often than not the companion, who's very clever, but isn't keyed in to the bigger picture, runs into a problem with an alien. And the doctor is in this person's life, and through the story, the doctor has to reveal the TARDIS,
right?
And then the companion proves themselves, and then at the end of the episode, the doctor is waiting next to the TARDIS, and saying, "All right, let's go on our adventures." I thought I didn't love it as much as you did. I thought it was good. I thought it worked. I thought Capaldi is very, very comfortable as the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a shaky first season. He had a really strong last season.
As his hair has gotten bigger, he's gotten more comfortable.
Yeah, he's got big hair in this. And he's kept the hoodie, which I like.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, his introduction in the last season was him riding a tank in playing electric guitar in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And this was him in an office,
mm-hmm.
you know, but
in an office where he's been lecturing now for more than 50 years.
Right. And I was trying to reconcile that in my head. And I was like, OK, has he been like coming and going? And then I realized, oh, no, he's been staying put because there's a sign on the TARDIS that says out of order.
Right.
And
right.
And we in modern Who. In between seasons can be hundreds of years for the Doctor. You know, this is just where he meets the new companion because he has a time machine and he's basically immortal. There's, you know, centuries of stories we'll never get.
Exactly.
So,
and what's interesting too is the way they've been telling his timeline. They've talked about basically 75 years now where we haven't seen his adventures. 50 years lecturing here at least. Plus, before that, in the last Christmas episode, they talked about how he had spent the last 24 years with River.
And that's just this doctor. I mean,
and that's just this doctor.
Matt Smith,
yeah,
jumped 200 years in, like, The Astronaut's Wife. So you have, right, these big gaps. Although, when you do the math, 50 years, we had the 50th anniversary special 4 years ago. So really, so the doctor's been at, because we're in present day, the doctor's, right, been at this university for the entire life of the television series of Doctor Who, which means the other doctors have been running around him.
Right.
And, you know,
oh, that's really interesting, because one of the things they've talked about is going back to the beginning, and Capaldi's always been a really big fan of old school Who. I really like the idea now that you mention it, that perhaps he started teaching at the very first time that Doctor Who first came on the air. I think that's kind of an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, and you know, they, in that 50th anniversary special, they gave Clara the job at Coal Hill, which was the same school from,
right,
from the Unearthly Child. Now Coal Hill is a spinoff series.
Right. And keep in mind, Coal Hill also appeared in Sylvester McCoy's big story about the Daleks, where it's actually in the chemistry lab at Coal Hill Academy that Ace beats up a Dalek with a baseball bat.
Oh yeah, that looked nothing like any Coal Hill they showed any ever. It was like, it seemed like a construction site.
Right.
They didn't have much money.
No, but what I did notice is that same, the street, well, actually in an episode of In Class, which we got the U.S. premiere of, and we already have so much stuff, so I don't want to go into too much detail there, but that takes place at Coal Hill Academy as well, which is basically Hellmouth now, is that they have the same, it's the same streetscape outside of Coal Hill Academy in Class that was in that Sylvester McCoy story as well.
Oh, that's, did you watch the premiere of Class?
I did.
I have it on my DVR, but I didn't get to it.
It's okay.
All right. I mean, I'd never really warmed up to any of the Doctor Who spinoffs. I could not finish Torchwood. I never finished Sarah Jane, but it really wasn't available in this country very well.
Right.
I think Amazon Prime had it for a little bit, but that was the only streaming site that had it. I've always felt like one show is enough. I mean, for the most part, when somebody tells me there's
what show would be enough if they would give us enough damn episodes?
Right. I was also kind of offended that they premiered the same night. We had a year and a half of no Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. They've been talking about Class for a year. Like, you could have put it on 3 months ago. Like, there's a lot of, right, time with nothing from this Doctor Who universe. And now you have two shows. You're burning them out. It's, you know, it's like when a cable show comes back and they show two episodes a week.
Right.
And then you're like, you have 13 episodes, but you're going to run it in 7 weeks.
Right, right. And didn't Class also premiere in Britain like a year ago?
Did it? Because I know Doctor Who's day and date, but...
Yeah, I seem to recall Class airing a while ago and just now coming to the U.S. I could be wrong about that.
Well, it's possible. It's only the most popular BBC shows that get here on time. You know, like,
right,
Doctor Who, Sherlock, both Moffat shows are like the same, right, day because you have to control spoilers. But I think Downton Abbey was always late here.
Yeah. 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 And I mean, but, you know, Doctor Who, it would be pirated in no time if they didn't just air it.
Well, I think it was because in the David Tennant era, it was coming out here a few months later.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the internet grew and grew, I think by the time Matt Smith took over, it just became BBC America at the same time it was on the BBC.
Right.
Because it would just be torrented.
Mm hmm.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I love Capaldi. You know, I've talked several times about my disappointment that they gave him a year off and he decided not to stay longer than the other,
right,
doctors. Three seasons is all you get.
Yeah.
You know, Matt Smith was 3 seasons. David Tennant was 3 seasons and a year of specials. Peter Capaldi was 3 seasons and a year off. But right. You know, but they say it takes 10 months to make 13 episodes of that show.
Yeah, it's, you know, I guess, and I guess it falls also under that trifecta. You can have it good, you can have it good, fast, cheap. Pick two.
Yeah. Yeah. And most of the doctors, like, they have a shaky first season.
Right.
They have an amazing second season. And then the last season is kind of a victory lap.
Right, right.
I mean, Tennant breaks that mold because most people consider his first season to be his best. And mm-hmm. his victory lap was the year of specials.
Was the year of specials. And there was some amazing things in there. But, you know, so much of that was so maudlin, too.
Right, right. Because, yeah, he was so sad to leave.
Right. Well, and, you know, when you start talking about, you know, that victory lap, one of the things that I found was really interesting in this episode, when we talk about doing sort of that callback to earlier Who, is on the doctor's desk. We've got obviously the picture of River, but we also have the picture of Susan Foreman, his granddaughter.
Right, because it's his wife and his granddaughter. It was the two family members that we know about the doctor.
Right, and representing Clara on his desk, although he probably doesn't know why, we have a raven.
I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's a raven sitting on the opposite corner of his desk, and I'm assuming that's a callback to Clara's quasi-departure.
Right, yeah, because Doctor Who always has to have it both ways.
Right, exactly. But it does bring to mind, like, I'm really, you know, and with the number of close-ups they did on that picture of Susan, I think that means we're going to see Susan Foreman sometime this season.
Huh. You think recast, or do you think...
You know, it could go either way. I mean, the actress is still alive, and I think that would be an interesting way to see her again, because, you know, what's interesting is...
Like Sarah Jane see her in the present day.
Yeah, we could certainly do that. I mean, when we left Susan Foreman, it was, I think, a couple hundred years past current time in war-ravaged London. She runs off with an Irishman who had been fighting the Daleks, and the doctor just sort of leaves her there. So it's a little future from now, but the actress is still alive, so we could certainly see her again. At the same time, she's a time lady, so she could certainly have regenerated.
Right, she could be. And she could be cast as anyone.
She could be cast as anyone. When I was talking earlier with girlfriend about this and talking about, you know, what role she could be, we could even see her theoretically being the new companion's grandmother or mother. Because we do have a scene.
We do have this mystery.
Who is this new companion? We've seen, and we know that the companion's mother has actually met the doctor.
Yeah, it was funny. Renee said when she saw the picture, she's like, wasn't that the friend of Amy and Rory? Isn't she Billy's mother? I was like, no, the friend of Amy and Rory was River.
It was River, exactly.
Because
exactly.
Stephen Moffat, timey-wimey.
River is named after herself.
Yeah, because Stephen Moffat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so what did you think of Billy as a companion?
I liked her. I liked her a lot because she's got this... She wants to be more. She wants to learn more. She's got this clever thing about her. She's got enough confidence to put herself out there, but she's also got enough of this sort of shaky insecurity that keeps her from being cocky and arrogant. And she is really in a position to try and learn and to explore. And I really like what we've seen of her so far. I like her, you know, she's scared of the right things. She doesn't scream a ton yet.
She doesn't scream at all.
Yeah. And she seems like she's got no idea what she's doing, but she's willing to learn and that she'll ultimately be quite capable. And I like her a lot.
Yeah, I'm still trying to get a feel of who she is outside of the next companion, because she checks off all the boxes that the companions
right.
need. It seems like they're toning her down because it was obvious, but it was clever that they cut in the teaser trailer that they made last year when they introduced Pearl Mackie.
Right.
They did that 2 minute of them running from Daleks, and it obviously had zero context. So, mm-hmm. you know, they were in that episode. They were like, well, we kind of told people it was the trailer. How do we cut it back in? But what they cut out was like the 30 seconds of her making fun of the Daleks.
Right. But yeah, they cut out. She doesn't have, and maybe that's one of the things I remember from the trailer in the back of my mind. She doesn't have quite that same level of snarkiness.
Right. And I'm wondering if that was a conscious choice. Yeah, because she makes fun of the fact that they have a sucker for a hand.
Yeah.
And, you know, Doctor Who tends to run as long as it does. I mean, here in America with commercials, it was an hour and 10 minutes.
Right.
So I don't think that was cut for time.
Right. Yeah. No, that was definitely cut for editorial purposes. And they still give her some of those moments where she's not like the snarkiness of talking about the plungers on the Daleks. But at the same time, she still is like able to call out things as that's kind of stupid, like in her conversations about the TARDIS with the door that, you know, it's supposed to blend in with the door that says, right. you know, pull to enter and why is it TARDIS in English? And
yeah, everything looked is metal, like a high tech kitchen, except
like
the doors are
kitchen.
Except the doors are wood.
Exactly. Did you run out of money?
Yeah. It was fun how long it took her when she goes, she's like, this isn't just a room, it's a lift. And then she goes, you mean this can go anywhere in the universe?
Exactly. Well, you know, the other thing I think was interesting, I don't know if it was deliberate or accidental, was as the Doctor and Nardal are waiting for her to get there, the implication in that conversation is that Nardal has been a part of this reveal a lot. And he's not used to seeing it take this long for somebody to get there with the bigger on the inside.
Yeah, Nardal is the character that Moffat will throw in every now and then. Nardal is the new Handles.
Yes, very much so. I think that was interesting. They revealed in this episode that the Doctor didn't put him back on a biological body, but on a robot or a cyborg.
Huh. Yeah.
Because they reveal that with at the very beginning, where he has a bolt fall off of his arm as he's directing Bill into the Doctor's office.
Oh, right. Yeah. So it's interesting. Yeah, because that's what Handles was just in that final episode of Matt Smith's, and he had been there a long time.
Yeah. So, yeah, almost 1,000 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And Nardal is also like the new Catherine Tate.
Right.
Where we saw him in a Christmas special a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now here he is as part of the whole thing.
Yep. Yep. So really the last three episodes of Doctor Who have included Nardal.
Yeah.
This one plus the two Christmas specials.
Which is funny because he was also in that episode of Community that made fun of Doctor Who. The season without Dan Harmon where people, the incontinuity reason was there was a gas leak in the school. So no one acted like themselves.
Right.
Which is the most Dan Harmon thing to do. Oh, you know what? We completely missed this. It was a week where a million things happened. Did you catch the April Fool's season premiere of Rick and Morty?
No, I did not. Rick and Morty is actually one of those shows I haven't started watching yet. I'm currently working my way through Steven Universe.
Yeah. Steven Universe is fun, but Steven Universe is more kid-like. See,
yeah.
you were a fan of Community, so mm-hmm. It's got that Dan Harmon feel. There's only two seasons. They're on Hulu. They're not on Netflix.
Sure.
But it's brilliant. But what they did, and I don't know if you saw the news story, the way Cartoon Network did April Fools was we've been waiting as long for Rick and Morty as we've been waiting for Doctor Who. Like we've been promised the third season. Right. And they said, we don't know when it's coming out. We don't know when it's coming out. So then the night of April 1st, instead of all of their shows from 8 to midnight, they premiered a new episode of Rick and Morty and showed it over and over and over again. And I went to check my DVR. I saw like rumblings on social media. So I went to check my DVR. And now there's a new season of Samurai Jack, which is wonderful on now.
Okay.
It's now on Adult Swim. It's a little more violent. They said this is absolutely the end of Samurai Jack, so this is closes the story. And okay. I've always loved that show. It's a beautiful show. So instead of that week's new episode of Samurai Jack,
they gave you a Rick and Morty.
They gave me a Rick and Morty. And I turned it on to look, and I was like, okay, what episode of Rick and Morty is this? Why don't I remember this? Wait, I don't. Oh, my God. I think this is a new episode of Rick and Morty. And I was like, but how do I record this? And I was like, oh, yeah, it's going to be instead of Samurai Jack anyway. Although the downside was I missed the next episode of Samurai Jack because when they finally showed it, the Comcast listed it as a repeat.
Right.
So now I need to find it on demand before I move on. But it was brilliant. I mean, we talk about it a lot on the show, but it's dark and it's genius and it's just moves so fast. And it's like a dark Doctor Who.
Okay.
But I highly recommend
okay.
it. It would be my greatest thing, but we've talked about it many, many times.
Sure.
Do you have Hulu?
I do.
Okay, go. Yeah, they have both seasons. They don't have that new premiere, but you know what? It is a show where you watch the first one and you know what you're going to get. And I gotcha. Haven't talked to anyone who's watched the first one and went, nah.
Okay.
But yeah, that was the brilliance where April Fool's is usually this thing where everyone lies to you about good things that are going to happen.
Right.
that instead Cartoon Network gave you a good thing without telling you anything about it.
Right. So it's a nice change of events.
Yeah. So so I would say we're both looking forward to the new season of Doctor Who.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah, I think I really loved last season. Like I personally it just hit me really hard, and I'm hoping it lives up to that. Capaldi's one of my favorite doctors. We know he's going to regenerate in the Christmas special this year.
Well, that becomes a question of, do we know that? Because mm-hmm. we know he's already filmed his regeneration. He has said in interviews that it is a non-traditional regeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And in the previews they've shown of this current season, we see him burst into a regeneration.
Well,
I don't know if it'll happen in July or if it'll happen at Christmas or if it'll happen a couple times.
Well, he did say on Graham Norton, he asked if he was done with Doctor Who. He said, well, I still have to tape the Christmas special. And he said, I have shot my death. So it's possible that whatever that regeneration scene is will be added to the Christmas special, but he's going to be in it.
And that gets really interesting. You know, it's, you know, we've got a whole new set of regeneration, and what else about the rules of regeneration have changed since the 50th?
And you know what? I feel like at this time we knew the doctor was Peter Capaldi. I feel like we have heard nothing, and I don't pay much attention to it because every doctor has been a British actor I have never heard of.
Right.
Until they became the doctor. Like, I remember they had a whole hour special to announce who the doctor was.
Yeah.
And Matt Smith came out and then they were like, and it's Peter Capaldi. And all of America went, who?
Exactly.
You know, now he's a household name. So I'm sure whoever they announce, you know, you can say Idris Elba as much as you want.
Right.
And you can say him for James Bond as much as you want. I think we're going to get somebody completely unknown to us. But at this point, when Matt Smith had 8 months to go as the doctor, we knew who the next was.
Oh, absolutely.
We haven't even heard rumors. I mean, we heard more about who was playing Cable in Deadpool 2.
Yeah. I mean, this is... But there's something different happening here.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting. So I'm looking forward to the overall season. But
definitely.
Moving on.
And I'm looking forward to figuring out what's in that vault.
Yeah. Well, there's always that central mystery.
Especially since we've also seen, and the other things they've talked about is we've also know that we're going to get both Missy and
John Sim.
John Sim.
Yeah, together. Which together. sounds like it's their 50th anniversary special.
Exactly. It'll be the two masters.
Yeah. So moving on from things we're looking forward to things we were looking forward to and now we have. We have a new season of Mystery Science Theater 3000. I don't know that anybody ever thought this was going to happen.
This is such a thing that just comes out of, you know, just the natural evolution of technology and the internet in our age. Essentially Jonah Ray leading the Kickstarter that got picked up and turned into a Netflix series, and all of Jonah Ray's fame comes from the background. You know, obviously he has had his career as a stand-up comic, but really got blown up through the Nerdist podcast, a medium that didn't exist 15 years ago.
Right. And yeah, this all started because Joel got the rights back. Mm-hmm. It had been bouncing around for years, and what we had had since the end of Mystery Science Theater, we had other attempts to do it in the digital age. Mike and Bill Corbett and Kevin Murphy, who were basically the second cast of Mystery Science Theater, have been doing the website Riff Tracks.
Right.
Really since the early to mid 2000s. And the way they do it is you buy an MP3 that's, like $4. And then you run your DVD or you stream the movie and run it mm-hmm. on a separate device and you sync it up.
And even Clay Cole Productions took a shot at it.
Yeah, we did that. I think we submitted. I don't know that anything happened. But yeah, we had our Audio Commentaries of Audio Commentaries podcast where we make fun of the director who made the bad film talking about it. But yeah, the benefit of Riff Tracks was they no longer needed the rights to movies because they weren't showing the movie.
Exactly.
So when you go to Riff Tracks, it's Harry Potter and it's the Avengers and it's Star Wars and it's Raiders of the Lost Ark and it's X-Men. It's all the stuff that Mystery Science Theater could never ever afford. So then Joel and Frank Conniff and Trace Ballou, all the original guys, created Cinematic Fantastique. Cinematic Titanic. I always think it's Cinematic Fantastique. I don't know why. I just always know it's not Cinema Paradiso. but they created these DVDs where they were still doing 50s B films, but they would sell a DVD for $30. And instead of being on the bottom in the seats, they were like on scaffolding on the sides and pointing at things. Neither one was really the spirit of it.
Sure.
I think both of them were kind of a consolation prize. And, you know, I saw both of them and I enjoyed them, but I never really became a fan of either one. I think what they were each missing was both of them were only about the movie. They didn't have the backstory around it. They didn't have the puppets. They didn't have the mad scientist. They didn't have the invention exchange. You know, the weird songs.
Right.
The breaks they took to do a sketch in the middle of the movie.
Exactly. And you need that. It's a palate cleanser, because otherwise you're just sitting there mocking something, which can be a lot of fun, but the whole volume of negativity that's inherent in that gets old without the context.
Yeah, it's the word you used about Pearl Mackey. It's the snarkiness of it. It just it very much just becomes sarcastic after a while. But in the new season of Mystery Science Theater, all of that is back.
Right.
We have a whole new cast because, as you said, Jonah Ray is the new Joel, basically, and Hampton Yount is playing Crow, who is uncanny. And Baron Vaughn, who I've always enjoyed, Baron Vaughn kicks off Black Dynamite, one of the funniest performances in that film. Baron Vaughn is Tom Servo, and he's doing his own thing with it.
Right.
But how are you feeling? You said you watched the first one, which is Reptilicus.
Right. Yes. Yes. I liked it a lot. I'm also, a big fan. It was also great seeing Will Wheaton in there and Aaron Gray and Felicia Day and Patton Oswalt and all these folks. And I really liked the sort of low production value side to it that appears intentional. The
although let's say the production values are way higher than they were on Comedy Central. Like, they can use green screen now.
Right, right. Well, you know, obviously the technology enables a lot of different things now.
Right.
At a very low cost. And the involvement of Paul and Storm and the music side of things is just, there's a lot of people involved in this that I am already a fan of, and it's a lot of fun, and I enjoy that context. And this first one, Riptilicus, man, that is a rough movie.
Oh yeah,
I think I might have nodded off at one point during that movie. Didn't miss any of the plot of Riptilicus, which was just it. You know, this is what you got to do to a movie like that.
Well,
and really sort of deflate it.
Yeah, I will say I'm about six episodes in, and they get funnier as they go on.
And okay,
there's some really horrible ones. One of the things they did, so this will be light spoilers, because one of the things they did with Mystery Science Theater was not announce what any of the movies would be until the series launched. And I think now, originally the episode guide just had numbers.
Uh-huh.
And you had to watch the episode to find out what the movie was. Now I think they have the actual titles on them. But this show is making me realize every detail that I loved about Mystery Science Theater. And, you know, there's a reason that people like Patton Oswalt and Will Wheaton and Paul and Storm and Jonah Ray are a part of it. Because I was saying this back when they were running the Kickstarter, is Mystery Science Theater, for me, is the birth of nerd humor. I mean, you know, we had things beforehand. We had things like Weird Al or Tom Lehrer.
Right. You know?
But I feel like...
But not on TV.
Yeah, and Mystery Science Theater was like completely embraced the fact that they were nerdy and dorky. Mm-hmm. And that they were, you know, there were a bunch of stand-ups from Minnesota who were never going to leave Minnesota.
Like, right.
Like Joel was the only guy that had ever done anything. And he had done some like stand-up spots on Saturday Night Live in the early 80s. And and quit and moved back to Minnesota by the late 80s after the comedy boom had happened. But he was the only one who had any showbiz acumen whatsoever. So it was these dorky guys. And it appealed to this whole generation of geek. Because it seems to be a touchstone. I know,
sure.
I know personally, for you and I, we were in college when the show premiered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was the first one in our group to discover it. Because I got cable that had Comedy Central. And I know Howie Weingarten, who's been on the show, used to come over every Saturday night because he didn't have cable. And he would come over every Saturday night and we would buy a pizza and 2 40s of Budweiser.
Uh-huh.
And we would watch Mystery Science Theater on Saturday night.
Uh-huh.
And then Sunday morning they would rerun it and we'd watch it again.
You know, and that's sort of why I missed it for the most part first time around, because as that came out in college, that was that era in my that dark era of my life where I didn't have a TV and then didn't have cable.
Yeah, but every time you visited me, I had a VHS few of them. We always watched like a couple.
Well, because we also remembered those were also movies that we had watched, you know, 10, you know, 5 to 10 years earlier when we were in grade school, and they'd come on at 4 p.m. on a weekday.
Right. And we would make fun of them. And that was the thing. The other thing I love about Mystery Science Theater was that it was like the natural end of the horror host.
Right.
You know, you have Sven Gulli, who is still doing it. Like he is.
He's a local Chicago dude. Isn't he?
He's a local Chicago dude. He's actually very good friends with Elliot Serrano. They have a public appearance coming up very soon, and we will plug it.
Awesome.
You know, he hosts at the Brookfield Zoo, which a friend of ours runs the education department. So my wife has met him several times. He's a local hero.
Sven Gulli. When is he going to be on Caffeinated Comics?
We're talking.
Awesome.
So we. But he's the guy. He's like the Jack White of of horror hosts. Mm-hmm. He's like the guy who's still out there doing it. But every market used to have them, and they went from just hosting to doing jokes, like Svengoolie does, and then Elvira pushed it a little further. Elvira would pause the movie. And then I feel like Joel was the next level of that, to be like, all right, look, we're only watching these movies to make fun of them, so let's just do that the entire time.
Right.
You know, and but everything about that show was just kind of dorky, and yet it resonated in a way that people just adore it. And
there's an authenticity about it.
Well, that's why their Kickstarter, I think they wanted $2 million and they got $6 million. Because people went so insane about it. Like, as soon as I heard about it, we did an entire show about the Kickstarter, because it was this very personal thing to a lot of people. And that's the best kind of entertainment you can possibly have, is everybody feels like it's made just for them. But there's a lot of those people out there. That's what Marvel Comics written by Stan Lee felt like.
Okay, yeah.
You know, you didn't realize that it was popular until you started seeing all of these people that were into it as much as you were.
Right.
But everything, I feel like everything's intact in this again. Mm-hmm. But it's not like just a reunion show. And that was my worry about it, was that it was going to be member berries. Mm-hmm. I explained this to Steven on the show, so I've already explained it. But did you see the last season of South Park?
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, in the last season of South Park, I'll be brief because I went into this whole explanation of it. But everyone became addicted to these berries called member berries.
Mm-hmm.
And they were berries that just talked about things in the 80s. And people would eat them and then give J.J. Abrams money.
Well,
that's,
okay, then.
Because that's South Park. Sure. So, I was talking to a friend of mine about a comic that was coming up, and I'm like, oh well, these guys who are legends on this book are going to be on it. He goes, yeah, but that book's going to be member berries, and I'm like, now it's a thing.
Now it's a thing.
So so yeah. I was worried that Mystery Science would be member berries, and on the same token, I was worried that it wouldn't be the same show because it's not the same people,
right?
And I feel like we did get both.
You know, it's like they've captured the spirit of it,
right?
With a sense of love for it, but not an excessive sense of reverence for it.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that have changed. I mean, you know, now there's jokes about TripAdvisor and Uber. Right. As we said, there's a lot more green screen. It's got a bigger budget than it used to. Mm-hmm. And it is reflecting kind of the humor of the day. It's much faster, I noticed.
Like, okay, yeah.
Mystery Science Theater had a lot of jokes. Like, the 90s were that period where joke density really grew, and The Simpsons was kind of the epicenter of that. But Mystery Science Theater was like, the fact that they were doing a joke every 20, 30 seconds was amazing. They're doing one like every five. And they're doing it, and they're delivering them faster because another one's coming.
Right.
Like, it could be because that's how we've accelerated in consuming comedy.
Right.
It's the viral video of movie riffing.
Mm-hmm. And the audience is ready for it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think how much of the Mystery Science Theater audience, at least in the very beginning, was there for the movie and not for the commentary.
I used to run into people in the 90s who were like, I try to watch Mystery Science Theater, but those guys got really distracting. And I was like, that's the whole point of it.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a movie in this one, which is, I think, is the turning point. The fourth episode is called Avalanche. And it's a typical 70s disaster movie.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's got names in it. Rock Hudson and Mia Farrow and Robert Forster are all in a ski resort and the avalanche hits.
Oh, that is 70s.
Yes, and there's a lot of 70s jokes, but it also made me realize my favorite episodes of Mystery Science Theater are the ones that are not genre films at all. Like, there's no monster, there's no space guy.
Okay.
Like, it's just a bad movie. Like, Like when Side Hackers is one of my favorite episodes ever. Rebels.
When they really thought they were making a big mainstream movie.
Yeah, or they were following a trend, but it wasn't a sci-fi trend.
Right.
Like, it wasn't always sci-fi. And that was one of the reasons the later seasons, when it moved to the Sci-Fi Network, I watched a few of them and I couldn't quite click in. I was a diehard Joel fan, and I liked Mike Nelson, but I thought he was a little bland.
Okay.
Like, Joel had real charisma. You know, Joel could be commanding. You could tell Mike was the head writer and they put him in front of the camera. And, like, I just started to slow down. I think I stopped watching it before it left Comedy Central. But when it moved to sci-fi, the one rule sci-fi gave them was don't show any movies that aren't sci-fi. And, you know, they used to show bad biker movies. And now they're showing bad disaster movies. There's a bad Bigfoot movie that's made in the 80s in this. And I was like, oh my God, we can start doing these straight to VHS movies. Because when Mystery Science Theater was made, those movies were only like 4 years old. So they were expensive.
Right. And I imagine now with so much of this straight to home video or straight to streaming, there's so much more content out there now too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously they're getting the cheapest movies they can, so you're not going to you're not going to see The Room on Mystery Science Theater.
The Room is so bad, it's too popular for Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, I do love that I saved The Room until a weekend when you were coming into town. I'm so glad we watched The Room and Birdemic and Troll 2, and we didn't sleep that night.
Oh. Yeah, those were so bad.
Yeah, they were so bad. There's a rant they do in the middle of one of the episodes where they say stop making bad movies on purpose. They're like there's enough bad movies. You don't have to take a natural predator and add a disaster to its name. But yeah, all the little things, and there's a lot of little Easter eggs in there that don't get in the way. But I noticed that the music, they even do commercial breaks without doing commercials, just because that's the way the old show went. Like they would just show a title card of Mystery Science Theater, and then Patton Oswalt would do a joke.
Yep,
and then it would just go right. It just goes right back into the movie because. That's what it was. It was every 15 minutes you had a break. And you knew that on the half an hour, when they came back, they would do a sketch. And then on the 15 minutes, they would go right back into the movie.
And that's, you know, that was interesting. As I was watching that, I was like, I suppose that it really helps, again, to sort of that palate cleanser of the rough movie. But also, I was like, are they also doing that in anticipation of potentially, you know, releasing this to traditional TV as well?
I don't think so, because the original plan was they were going to create a website and they were going to host it on their own website. And, you know, the Kickstarter had all of these tiers. They said, like, the bottom was they were going to do three and it was going to be on their website. And they were talking about a subscription model, you know, kind of like CBS is doing for the new Star Trek. Of like, you know, pay $20 and watch all 14. And then, you know, then Netflix got involved. So I think it was always meant to be streaming. I think those breaks are just because that's how they know how to pace the show.
That's how they pace the show.
Yeah. As we just said with things like Riff Tracks, it kind of wears you down just sitting there watching a movie and having no breaks and nothing else going on.
Right. And I suppose that's an interesting point to consider for sort of the future of media as we start to see more and more of the stuff going straight to streaming, which takes out the traditional episode timing. If you have an hour and 15 minutes of content, you can do an hour and 15 minutes. If you only have 37 minutes for an episode, it can be only 37 minutes long. I wonder how if many shows or directors have started to grapple with the idea of commercial breaks in TV isn't just to allow the revenue producing commercials, but also such an important element of pacing and of giving the audience a break and of managing that. I think that that becomes an interesting point of discussion for it.
Right. I mean, most shows are following the HBO model of, you know, most shows are like, we're going to run the show all the way through because HBO does it with no commercials. Mm-hmm. And they take no breaks, whether it's a comedy like Curb Your Enthusiasm or a drama like Game of Thrones. That's how everyone doing streaming wants to pace it. And Mystery Science Theater is like, nope. we take these beats and we break it up because mm-hmm. that's the way we originally did it. And that's the way we're going to keep doing it. Another nice little touch is this show is so much bigger budget. First of all, they made it in L.A., not Minnesota. But the credits now run so long that they play the mm-hmm. entire Mystery Science Theater love theme, which they always used to play. Mm-hmm. And then they have to play more music.
Right.
Because there's way more people that worked on this show than have worked on it before.
Well, that's also Kickstarter backers listed in the credits too, aren't they?
Right, yeah. And it looks like they're breaking them up because there's so many. Because I was just I was just finishing an episode and all of the names started with E.
Okay. Yeah,
so I think they're breaking them up. But they're playing new music and I realize, hey, wait, that's a song. That's the commercial jingle they wrote for Wild Rebel Cereal. And then there was one where they were playing the Creepy Girl song.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember these because Howie and I would sing them to each other when when we were in bars and women wouldn't talk to us. We would just look at each other and he'd be like, they're wild rebels, crunchy, fruity rebels. And they play that every mm-hmm. episode because they know there are fans that dedicated. They go, hey, isn't that Wild Rebels? And Wild Rebels was just one movie they did.
Mm-hmm. And they've got all this content.
Yeah. But I'm really enjoying it. And I think it's funny because it took me 3 months. No, it wasn't that long. It just felt like it. It took me 3 weeks to get through Iron Fist. And Mystery Science Theater is a half an hour longer. And it launched on Friday. And I was out of town Saturday afternoon to Sunday afternoon. And I've watched 6 of them.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest thing in the world
this week.
So my greatest thing in the world this week is actually something that's a few years old. It is on Hulu. You can watch seasons 1 and 2 of Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex. Now, Ghost in the Shell, of course, is a movie that started out as anime based on a manga. And was just recently redone as a live action thing starring Scarlett Johansson, which apparently the critics panned and created all sorts of controversy due to questions about, a Caucasian actress playing a historically Japanese character. But setting aside all of that, if you have Hulu, go and watch Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex.
Is it also anime?
It is anime. It is 2 seasons, about 25 episodes each. And it really goes in depth in a lot of exploring the idea of the singularity of what happens as humans become more machine and machines become more human, and exploring ideas of artificial intelligence, of hacking people, of augmented humans. There's a movement that follows the arc of a separate religious cult that opposes all augmentation for people. And it's really interesting. The Ghost in the Shell title itself basically refers to the soul or the mind that exists within a biological shell or a computer shell or some other combination of the two.
Yeah, it's also called Ghost in the Machine, which actually the Police used as a title to one of their albums.
Yeah. And it's really a fascinating way of looking at these ideas without, getting into the expository. We're going to talk about the implications of this idea. It just sort of lets the story play out as you follow sort of the exploits of Section 9, which is a special high security division of the Japanese government. employing a lot of these the cyborgs and somebody without augmentation and other people with augmentation and how they communicate. And it's really a lot of very fascinating think pieces while still having – it's still full action, full lots of violence and all sorts of things like that. Now, for some reason in the story, of course, one of the major character is pretty much naked most of the time or nearly naked, which they don't really give a reason for, but
anime,
it's the reason, exactly. They don't really give us a canon reason for it. They do kind of do in the movies, and that, that's the only way to be invisible when they turn on the invisible stuff, but whatever. But, if you can set aside that issue, and yeah, there's certainly some problematic aspects to that. But it is really, I'm really engrossed in the show, and the music is absolutely fantastic. I'm really digging the music on here. It's not J-pop. It's a bigger, sort of darker, more complex music. And I am just loving this series. I'm about halfway through season one, following the arcs and each episode becoming its own self-contained thing. And, if the idea of sort of any sort of cyberpunk genre, sort of the whole man machine type of thing is something you're interested in, definitely check out Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex.
Yeah, I definitely want to check it out. My only complaint with the original Ghost in the Shell, and I remember seeing it when it first came to America and having to sit in the aisle in the movie theater because it was so packed. I loved it, and then I felt like it just ended. And I was like, wait, I feel like this story didn't resolve.
Right.
And at the time we were debating, there was, that's Eastern storytelling as opposed to Western. So to find out there's a series that follows it makes me very, very interested.
Right. Well, what's really interesting about the movie too, and the one from the 90s and whatnot, is that essentially it's sort of like the adaptation of books 4 through 7 of a comic book series.
Yeah, so it's originally manga.
And all the stuff that comes after it. So it's really sort of one arc within a broader story. So, the Ghost in the Shell movie really lacks some context in that respect.
Right. My favorite thing in the greatest thing in the world this week is a piece of technology that's only a couple of months old, but it's the next generation of something that's old, that's been around for a while. I finally got an Apple TV.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I got it was I work in the Hancock Center now. And if you've been to Chicago, if you've been to the Hancock Center, it's one of the tallest buildings in the world. There is a Best Buy in the lobby, which I learned you don't have to leave the building to get to. I can go out of my elevator and go in a Best Buy, which is great for me because when Blu-rays come out, I can get them at lunch. So when Rogue One came out, went down the elevator, got it at lunch, came up. And everyone at work was looking at me funny, and I haven't been at this job very long, so I'm like, ah, damn, am I the only like geeky guy here? Where they're gonna be weird because I watched Star Wars, but no, they all went, why would you buy a disc? I was like, well, I want to have the movie. I can't trust streaming. They're like, but you want a physical disc that you need to bring to your house. And it stuck with me, not just because, all right, I'm out of step with the times, with technology, which bothers me, but because I'm a collector, I want to make sure that the movie is mine, and I don't really trust the cloud. And I've learned you can't trust Netflix or Hulu because they take stuff down every month. I mean, there's websites devoted to what's leaving Netflix this month.
Amazon's even been known to pull stuff off your Kindle.
Yeah, yeah. When they lose the rights, you just can't see it anymore, even if you paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, well, discs are the way to go. But I started to think about, okay, what happens the day that my Blu-ray player breaks down and I go to Best Buy and there aren't any Blu-ray players? And then I go on Amazon and there's like one old one for $500. Like, I'm banking on obsolescent technology. And I realize this. It's like I'm riding the VHS train, right down the hole. So this just kept playing on my mind. And as I looked at my Rogue One Blu-ray, I was like, you know what? This has a digital copy. So, and you know what? I never get around to redeeming my digital copies. And so I have, my Blu-rays are full of codes that I never put in. So, except for maybe my favorite films. So last weekend, I was like, let me go through my entire Blu-ray collection, which is like three bookcases at this point, and input every code. And honestly, it was a Friday night of beer and typing.
Woohoo!
But at the end of it, I learned that I had about 100 movies on iTunes.
Wow.
Some of them I'm probably not, I'm probably not going to watch. You know, my collection has really two tiers. There are films and television series that I know I'm going to watch every year.
Sure.
And there are films and television series that I just have on the shelf and I will forget about for 5 years. And then I'll go, hey, I haven't seen that movie in a long time and it's a classic and I know I have it. You know, films like The Godfather and Blade Runner or even Terminator. I don't get to those often, but when I do, I'm so glad I have them.
Right.
So I have now have this digital library and then I'm looking at ways to watch it. And most of them are walk around your house with your iPad. And then I
yeah.
And I have a Google Chromecast and we watch Netflix and Hulu through the PlayStation. So I have ways to get streaming on my televisions, but I realized Apple TV is the only game in town if you want to watch your iTunes files.
Right.
And also it allows AirPlay so you can watch your crappy ultraviolet digital copies, and don't get me started on ultraviolet because I could do a whole show about how much I hate ultraviolet, but I can at least AirPlay them. So I bought the new Apple TV, and this new generation is only about a month old, and I'm like in love with it. And one of the things I love about it is this new operating system has integrated itself so well that it talks to its own apps. So it has Siri, and this is the only time in my life I have ever used Siri. The only other time I've used Siri is Ben and I sat around for like a half an hour seeing how many things Siri could get wrong. Turns out, all of them.
Nice.
But the Siri on the Apple TV works really well if you just say titles of franchises.
Okay.
And it integrates Hulu and iTunes and HBO Go. So, for example, I said to Siri, X-Men. That's all I said. Mm-hmm. And it pulled up a screen that says, here's the 10 X-Men films that they made that you put in iTunes because Fox put a digital code on all of them. Oh, and by the way, here's the X-Men animated series from the 90s on Hulu. And here's Wolverine and the X-Men, which is also on Hulu. And here's X-Men Evolution. What kind of X-Men would you like to watch today?
Right.
And then within nice. One click, I'm watching any one of them. And it's really nice. Like, so I said Indiana Jones, and right now Hulu has all four films. And it says, well, do you want to watch them on Hulu or do you want to buy them on iTunes? Because iTunes has everything. So I haven't been this impressed with an Apple product maybe since the Retina screens came out. Like, I have been complaining that they plateaued a long time ago. And granted, you know, a lot of these probably aren't a huge leap from the third generation, which I never owned. But I haven't enjoyed an Apple product this much in a while. And I feel like, oh, okay, this is the next level.
This is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah. The other thing I did was buy a lot of movies that didn't have digital codes in the Blu-rays.
Of course.
And I had this argument with myself, and this is how I'll end the show. So I realized I had to buy Army of Darkness on iTunes, and it was $15. And I'm mad because I bought the Blu-ray 2 years ago, and it didn't come with a digital code. I'm like, how dare they not put a digital code? I bought this Blu-ray, and this is a movie I watch all the time. It's one of my favorite movies. And
you
now
bought that Blu-ray, you bought that DVD, you bought that VHS.
That was the conversation I had immediately. And I was on a two-hour drive by myself, and I had this out loud. Hey, how many times have you paid for Army of Darkness? Now, not action figures or books about it, or going to a signing with Bruce Campbell. How many times have you actually paid to watch Army of Darkness? And then I realized, well, I saw it in the movies, and then I bought the DVD, and then I bought the director's cut DVD, and then I bought the Blu-ray, and then I bought the director's cut extended edition Blu-ray, and now I'm buying it on iTunes. And I realized there's no reason for me to blame iTunes for a pattern I have been following for 20 years. And with that, Bill, how do we find you online?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at currentlybill. And you can also follow my podcast, 2 Minute Talk Tips, where you can become a better public speaker in as little as 2 minutes a week. And if you've got more than 2 minutes a week, you can stick around for an extended discussion. And this week, the episode that is going to be launching on April 18th features our very special guest, John Clark, talking about how to manage panels at a convention. So we are real excited about that. Check out 2 Minute Talk Tips at 2MinuteTalkTips.com, and that's the numeral 2. You can also subscribe in Google Play Music as well as in iTunes.
Ooh, I got to get on that Google Play Music. I haven't done that with Caffeinated Comics. But you can follow me at Not On My Book on Twitter, and you can follow the show on Facebook.com/Caffeinated Comics. And you can also, we're on iTunes, we're on Stitcher. I got to get in that Google Play Music. I think I submitted it to Blueberry, and I never followed up. But you can also listen to any episode we've done since January 2013 at caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. Bill, it is always fun to talk to you.
Always a blast.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.